Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Anthony Brooks is out today. When you hear that superstar architects Renzo Piano and Norman Foster both designed headline-grabbing buildings that stand right around the corner from each other and opened within a little more than a year of each other, you might think we're talking about the latest building boom in New York. But we're not. We're talking about right here in Boston. Foster, of course, designed the massive Art of the Americas wing at the Museum of Fine Arts. It opened in late 2010. And today, Renzo Piano makes his mark on another Boston arts institution, the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum and its new $114 million expansion, which reopened to the public this morning. We're going to talk about museums, art, and architecture, and how the three are meeting in exciting and maybe sometimes contradictory ways in Boston. So we'll do that in a bit, but we're going to start with this brief tour from Radio Boston's Adam Ragusea, which begins at the MFA.
So I wonder if you'll indulge me long enough to tell you about one of my pet peeves. I'm standing in front of the Huntington Avenue entrance to the MFA. And, you know, whenever, like, a beautiful old building gets remodeled or added onto, I feel like the first thing they always do is move the entrance. So you'll walk up to something that was clearly designed to be the entrance. It's got big columns and the big staircase, and everything about it is screaming, here, here, come here, here's where you're supposed to be. You walk up to it, and then there's a little teeny sign by the door handle that says, use other door. And then you have to walk around to something that doesn't look like an entrance at all and go in. I hate that. So one of my favorite things about the new MFA is that they didn't do that. If anything, they made this main Huntington Avenue entrance even more prominent. If you want to go to the new part of the MFA, you got to go in and you got to hang a right.
The new wing was designed by English architect Norman Foster and his firm, a top international practitioner of the modern glass and steel arts. That skyscraper in London that people call the Gherkin because it's shaped like a pickle, that's Foster. But he's also known for less flashy, even deferential renovations and additions to historic structures. Here's Foster from his 2008 TED Talk.
As an architect, you design for the present with an awareness of the past for a future which is essentially unknown.
You can really see that ethic at play in the Shapiro family courtyard, kind of the marquee interior space of the new wing.
My name is Katie Getchell. I'm deputy director at the Museum of Fine Arts. We call this a jewel box. It is a very large glass transparent space that is set within the historic structure. So on the west, north, and south, you have the exteriors of the old building. And about 20 feet inside of that on the north and south is this new courtyard. So we've maintained the landscaping between the old and new buildings so you can still see the historic structure. You still have a sense of green, sense of being outside, inside, seasonal changes.
And talk about seasons. During last year's crazy winter, the snow piled so high in that narrow space between the glass and the original stone walls beyond that visitors were presented with a head-tall cross-section of snowbank all the way around. Even in the bleak of winter, the space remains amazingly bright.
Yes, it is very bright.
These visiting Lesley University students, Carissa Becker and Brianna Conserva, agree with my assessment.
It's, like, surprising because it's, like, blocked with, like, buildings on either side.
Right, like, usually when you have a window in a building, there's the outside.
Right, like a view.
the view is another building.
Right, but it's still very open.
So walking around the corner from Huntington Avenue onto Forsyth Street, you can really get a sense of the exterior of the wing. It's kind of got three parts. In the middle, there's a big glass box. And then flanking either side of the glass box are these two other boxes that consist of more stone with some glass. And I'll tell you, they really, really remind me of the Dutch painter Piet Mondrian. Kind of haphazard arrangements of rectangles and dark black bars. One of the weird things about the glass cube in the center of the building is that if you stand on the sidewalk, you're right across these huge panels of glass from a hallway, and there's a security guard standing, like, 6 feet away from me on the other side of the glass, and we're just staring at each other right now. Hi. I think she's going to release the hounds.
So that's the new MFA wing. Literally right around the corner, the Gardner Museum cut the ribbon on their addition this morning.
One, two,
Mayor Menino is a guy who looks comfortable wielding a 2-foot pair of ceremonial scissors. The scrum of reporters and assorted muckety-mucks elbows its way upstairs to hear the mayor speak in the new Calderwood Performance Hall, a chamber music venue that still smells of fresh-cut cedar. There's some kids from Mother Caroline Academy in Dorchester here, too.
Which one of you guys would like to try to describe this room for me? You want to try?
Okay.
Our volunteers are Miriam Rodriguez and Camille Garrick, both 11.
What's it shaped like?
A square.
It has lots of glass. It has very big lights. And the floor is solid.
Yeah, then there's like 3 floors of red movie-like theater chairs, kind of like an opera house.
Do you like it?
Yeah, it's really nice.
One of the things you'll notice as you see the expansion going on, where the classrooms are for the kids. They're not in the basement anymore. They're on the first floor. Shows respect they have for these young folks who are going to be our cultural leaders of the future.
Indeed, functionality and respect are the two big themes of this building. Functional in that it was designed to accommodate all of the gardener's non-picture-hanging activities. The classrooms, the gift shop, the coat check, the concert hall, take it all out of the original 1903 palace and put it somewhere else where it won't get in the way. The idea of respect brings us to Italian architect Renzo Piano, another international superstar. He did the 2007 New York Times building.
I love it, the Isabella Garden Palace. I love it, that beauty.
In his interview with WBUR's Andrea Shea, Piano said he didn't want to do anything that would detract from the palace. In fact, he built the new wing out of glass so that inside you could hardly escape the view of the palace.
You enter and then you see the palace. Then you go up to the first, second floor, and by walking up on the stair, you see the palace. The palace is always there, the object of desire.
So I'm standing in the center of the new gardener wing in the staircase, and I can see basically all components of it around me because everything is glass. To my right on the first floor, there's this very welcoming space called the living room with wooden bookshelves and orange couches and throw rugs. It kind of looks like some rich person's ski chalet. To my left, I can see the new cafe, which has all these red chairs and red lights and kind of looks like a rich person's ski chalet. Beneath me, there is the narrow glass hallway which connects the new wing to the original palace. And from here, you can really get a sense that these are two totally different buildings. They have nothing to do with each other architecturally that my eye can see. And they're really set quite far apart from each other, save for this tiny little glass piece of connective tissue connecting them together.
The exterior of the new wing is harder to describe. In classic Renzo Piano fashion, it's multidimensional, multicolored, covered in staircases and screens, metal and glass panels. It's a contemporary statement, which leads me to this concluding point. Remember what I was saying before at the MFA about preserving original entrances? They did not do that at the Gardner. All foot traffic will now come through this elaborate glass and steel edifice. Perhaps one place at the new Gardner and MFA wings where the future definitely won out over the past.
That's Radio Boston's Adam Ragusa, who's back with us in the studio now. Thanks for that, Adam.
It was a pleasure. It's fun to go to these two places and take a fresh look at them.
Good. Will you stick with us?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, listeners, we are talking about cutting-edge museum architecture in Boston, especially given the fact that this morning the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum reopened to the public with its new expansion. What do you think? Have you seen it? Did Renzo Piano honor the original Venetian-styled palace and its intent with his new glass and steel structure? Same question for Norman Foster's addition to the MFA around the corner. And what do you make of the fact that some of the most exciting architecture in town is happening at some of our oldest artistic institutions? What do you think are the challenges of bringing architecture forward in a city with as much history as Boston? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us online. We're at Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Well, joining us now is George Thrush. He's professor and director of architecture at Northeastern University, and he blogs about the built environment at Boston Magazine. Professor Thrush, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks very much, Meghna.
Also with us is Sebastian Smee. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning art critic for the Boston Globe, and he wrote about the Gardner edition in the most recent Globe magazine. Sebastian Smee, great to have you back.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, Professor Thrush, let me just first start with you and ask you, what do you make of Renzo Piano's addition to the Gardner? Is it a success in your eyes?
Oh, very much so. And I'm not surprised. He's a fantastic architect. It is really interesting that the two editions are very they're both very high quality, but they're very different approaches in a way. One is really an extension of the existing museum. I'm talking about the MFA, and the other one is, for a lot of reasons, a completely separate enterprise, like Adam suggested.
Sebastian, do you share that view?
Yeah, look, I'm also a big fan of Renzo Piano. I think he's an amazing architect. I have some reservations about the Gardner. I think, on the whole, it's been a great idea to build a new building and get all those ancillary functions, the shop, the cafe, the temporary exhibition space and so on, out of the old building. They were crammed in there and they didn't really belong. So that's great. And like I said, Renzo Piano is great. But I do feel that having that building there, and as Adam said in his great and very funny report, that having that new entrance there means that you can no longer get the experience that I think Isabella Stewart Gardner wanted you to have. She had a very particular idea about how she wanted people to enter her museum. Mm-hmm. And you now have to negotiate this whole new building, which has a completely different philosophy to it. As you said, it's a total contrast. So for me, that's a shame. The other shame is that they had to knock down the carriage house to get
right.
this new building. And that building was much more than just a carriage house. It was symbolically incredibly important to Isabella Stewart Gardner. We can perhaps talk about that. But for me, they're my reservations. I do think that having people in there and having the books on the shelves and so on has really warmed the space, and I'm quite pleased with the result. But I do have those reservations.
Adam?
Well, one interesting contrast that came to mind for me seeing them back to back was that I think part of the reason the conversation is different when it comes to the Gardner is that the Gardner edition is the first edition to the Gardner, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas the MFA has been amended many times over its history. And one thing that, you know, I didn't know about that happened during this most recent renovation period was that a lot of the internal order of the building was kind of restored. There were these north-south axes and these very, you know, these corridors and kind of the internal logic of the building that was original and inherent to it had all gotten messed up over time as it was added on to and different functions were roped off in different places. They really tried to knit it all back together the way it was intended to in the process of putting on this new appendage.
Right. Yeah, but it's balanced again, isn't it? It's great. I mean, I agree with you. It restores that sort of central spine of the MFA.
It's symmetrical.
Exactly. Yeah.
At the MFA. But you, Sebastian Smee, you bring up a good point, and George Thresher wanted to ask you about that. While there's the sort of programmatic needs of museums when they expand. I mean, especially as a place like the Gardner, which is seeing some 200,000 visitors a year in this day and age, many more than when Isabella Stewart Gardner first conceived of the
sure.
museum. There's also, as Sebastian was saying, the intent of the museum itself and how a building honors that. Do you think that that has happened here with the piano edition?
Well, I think this is actually a great point of entry to this subject because I think that they were honored, the original intentions of both museums were honored in very different ways. In the Gardner Museum, it's a kind of programmatic extension of the mission of the building. In other words, by taking out all of the inner workings, by reorienting the entrance, by introducing things that didn't exist before, like greenhouses and things like this, nobody could say that's a extension of the original building. That is an extension, perhaps, of what people infer to be the mission of the Gardner Museum. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think the extension of the MFA is a much more formalist architectural extension of the 1910 museum. And your intro was dead on when it said that you didn't explicitly refer to the IMPE edition in mm-hmm. the 70s, I guess, which completely altered in many very bad ways the entry sequence and therefore made the museum unbalanced, and there were a lot of places that people didn't get to. So the irony is that the expansion of the MFA is partly this really interesting Art of the Americas wing, which we could talk about, which also has an interesting pedagogical and curatorial aspect to it, but also just the sort of structural reworking of how the museum operates.
Sebastian, I want to draw you out a little bit more because your piece in the Globe magazine was quite eye-opening. Basically, you make the argument that what's happened here is that in this day and age, museum curators, museum directors, and architects who design for museums aren't giving museum goers themselves enough credit. I mean, they basically that a modern museum goer needs everything ordered in a manner that makes sense. They need big art to be told to them, this is big, by being in a big room.
And it's important. It's by such and such
and
an
that's sort of the
so
clutter,
on,
yeah. the surprise, and the strangeness, is the word you used, about the Gardner Museum was part of her vision, and that's been lost. It doesn't give people credit that they can recognize
right.
and experience the artfulness of actually being there.
Right. It was crucial to her mission and her idea. I mean, you think about it. This building is this sort of fairly opaque and in some ways unattractive brick building, and you cannot even begin to guess at what's going to be inside from outside. But then you walk in from the cold Boston winter street, and there's this aha moment. It's just, wow,
it's a wonderland.
Incredible. You see this, yeah. You see this courtyard with plants and gorgeous lighting, and this sort of the walls that evoke a Venetian palazzo, and fragments of antique sculpture and so on. And it's spellbinding. It's transporting, and you lose your bearings. And that's part of it. That's part of this spell that she wanted to create. And I think that that is actually something that is almost the antithesis of the way most museums work today. They want everyone to feel comfortable and relaxed and edified and
know where the bathrooms are.
Know where the exactly. All the amenities need to be close at hand. And I just sort of I respect both possibilities. But the Gardner Museum is so unique. There's nowhere else in the world like it. It's completely special and something that this city needs to be so proud of and so careful about interfering with, I think. I don't want to say that I think that it's a disaster, this new building. Not at all. I think there are many things about it that are great. But I do think it's a shame that we can't anymore have that exact experience that she intended.
Yeah, but I'd have to say, I don't think, I mean, I not only did I tour the museum for the very first time this morning, and it was wonderful, I'd seen it from the outside during the later stages of construction, but today was the first time I went in. And it is true, Sebastian is of course completely right, that the entry sequence is different now. On the other hand, I think the entry sequence does very much build on a logic of the Gardner that is a perfectly legitimate architectural one. In other words, it engages you in a sequence that leads you right into the interior courtyard very nicely. But I'd also say that, you know, I also walked through the galleries of the museum again, and you're totally right. It is such an even more eccentric than I recalled from my last visit. You know, it's a medieval museum practically. I mean, with the tapestries, there's probably half a dozen of these fireplace shrouds that are, you know, you just don't see anywhere else. And so it is really eccentric and idiosyncratic. But I would say that spatial experience and the whole business of walking down narrow corridors and then having to go practically, it's like a haunted house almost. When you go from one corridor to another, you hope you're not going to fall off a ledge. But I would say you still get all that. It's just that you do have the ordered, rational, clear, light-filled, and what Piano would call intentional juxtaposition to the dark, idiosyncratic spaces of the Gardner.
I want to get to a couple calls in a second, but Sebastian, I want to throw this back to you, and Adam, chime in if you have any thoughts. I mean, in Adam's piece, we heard Norman Foster in his TED Talk say, an architect's duty is to design for the present, with the past in mind and the future on the horizon, but to design for the present. So is this not the need of a present-day museum in Boston?
Well, it is a need to get these functions out of the old building. That was really important, and they've done it well. Did they need to do it with a building that embodies a philosophy that's the complete antithesis to Gardner? I don't know. I mean, they make an argument that it's kind of like yin and yang, that they're complements. I don't quite buy it. I find there's a dissonance there. And I think that there's a tendency for people to feel almost a little embarrassed about Gardner and her vision. And even maybe the museum's leadership as well. It feels, you know, they've been hearing for years and years, gosh, you know, when are you going to do something about the lighting? And it's a bit of a jumble, isn't it? And why can't we have clear wall labels? I just want to say, hey, just embrace it. It's completely unique. It's an extraordinary experience. And it tells us so much about Gardner's time and all these other important Boston figures who shared to some degree those philosophical attitudes. Henry James and Bernard Berenson and all these people who were part of her circle.
And that quote that you mentioned, Meghna, about building for the present while respecting the past, that's from Foster, who built the MFA edition.
Right.
And one totally random little example of that is that if you're at your computer right now, you can look at the Google Map imagery, which is relatively up to date for that part of the city, and you can see the complete MFA with the new edition from above. And when you look at it down at it that way, you can see that the new edition, like you said before, Sebastian, restored symmetry to the entire building. It looks right. It looks complete. And that's a little different, maybe, than what we're seeing at the Gardner Museum.
On the other hand, I do note from reading some of what other architecture critics have had to say about Piano, who designed for the Gardner. I mean, he's had his hand in a lot of museum expansions over the years. The Whitney, I believe, in New York, the Morgan Library in New York, even the Art Institute in Chicago. That was a big one.
And he's working on the Harvard Art Museum here, of course.
Right now.
Fog. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And, I mean, a lot of people find his style to be sophisticated but not too threatening, which works for museums, maybe.
I think that's right.
Well, this is really, I think, a really important point. I was talking with some colleagues about this earlier today. You know, for those of us who were trained as architects in the 1980s, the difference between now and then in terms of museum is so stunning. It's hard to speak about it. You
for
know,
those who weren't trained as architects,
well, let me just—I'm going to give you just a little bit here. The Whitney, which is now going to use Renzo Piano, you know, in around 1985, everyone was hot about a scheme by Michael Graves to span over the existing Whitney Museum by Marcel Breuer, which is a very idiosyncratic building in its own right, bridge over it with this crazy addition that would have, let me just say, would have been awful. It would have been a faux historic piece of nonsense. And we benefit, and Whitney benefits from the fact that they delayed and didn't build back then, because now they're going to get something that is, we're much better suited in many ways to do these museums now for curators and for artists rather than only for the architects from the outside. I mean, you contrast these Piano and Norman Foster museums with the Denver Art Museum, for example, which is not about housing the art at all, but it is about making a statement that, hey, we in Denver have art, which is a fairly singular position. Whereas these museums in Boston, the reason we're spending almost $1 billion in the last 5 or 6 years is that there is this is such a mature kind of cultural situation. There are ideas to continue. Whether you like Isabella Stewart Gardner's view of the world or not, it's clear that there is one. And that's a great thing for us.
Well, I want to pick up on that point a little bit more because I think it's an important one. But we have a lot of callers who want to join us, so I want to welcome them in. We are talking about museum expansions in Boston and some cutting-edge architecture also in the city, and whether or not that architecture is honoring the vision of the art within it. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Afshan is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Afshan.
Hi there. Hi, George. It's Afshan. We talked together, and hey, Meghna, we've also met.
Hello,
my husband,
Afshan.
Scott. Hey, Scott and I got a chance to preview the Gardner Tuesday night, and you know, we are big Renzo groupies. We've seen, I guess, nearly all his museums, and I guess I wanted to get your opinion on. We enjoyed it tremendously, Gardner, especially the design of the auditorium, which I thought reminded me of Kabuki style. Venues, but I was wondering about what you thought about the museum turning its back on the greenery, you know, Olmsted and the green of
the Fenway.
The Fenway, yeah, sorry. And what you thought about using the greenhouse on a very important site or side of the museum that could have actually opened up the museum to the outdoors.
Afshan, let me get Professor Thrush's thoughts on that. Thanks for your call. George Thrush?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I agree that both are unusual moves. I would share Sebastian's concern about what we don't really know ultimately, or like I can't tell ultimately what has been the front of the museum is going to look like from the Fens. Right now they have a beautiful kind of sketch poster in front of the entrance. But if it's not going to be a functional entrance, it does remain to be seen whether that gets turned into a niche or something. I don't know. As for foregrounding the greenhouse on the new main facade of the building, you know, I just think that is a choice about trying to broadcast this green mission and outreach mission and landscape mission of the institution. And I think it is unexpected, but I think it's kind of interesting.
Adam? jump in here. Do you have a thought?
Yeah, I think it's. I think George is right in saying that it's crucial to figure out what they're going to do with that opening. I was just there, and I was totally baffled by it. The original entrance on the Fenway,
right.
Which is, I mean, as you mentioned, Sebastian, it was never that remarkable. It wasn't what I alluded to at the beginning of my piece. It wasn't one of these entrances that screams, "Here, here, come here." It was kind of like, "Come over here if you want," you know. Mm-hmm. But it was designed to be understated. But now it's just like. It's got a construction tarp over it, a beautifully decorated right. construction tarp, but it's a construction tarp. And I don't know what they're going to do with it. It's going to be really, really weird.
Well, let me throw also another question open to all of you, and Sebastian, you first, because Afshan mentioned, when she mentioned the Fenway, that whole neighborhood has been largely transformed by the addition of just these two buildings, yeah. let alone all the other construction that's been going on down there. I mean, just your thoughts on the effect of, you know, as you said, almost $1 billion yeah. worth of building so concentrated in one area in Boston.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, maybe George can speak to this better than I can, but it's definitely in the process of transforming. I mean, Boston and Cambridge, they're remarkable towns for the number of sort of experimental buildings that they have. MIT campus is filled with these extraordinary buildings, and they don't necessarily knit together very well. So I do think that it's really important that architects try harder to try and knit the buildings together with their context, and I think that both in both these instances they've tried to do that, and the MFA has now got an entrance that you know faces onto the Fenway, which is really important, so you can get in both ends. So I do think there's a greater sensitivity to all this, which is a good thing.
Hmm.
Well, I would say you know. It's not just the art museums over in that area. You know, the Longwood Medical area is unbelievably, I mean, it's bursting at the seams. And yeah. so every other year you see another reflective glass
gigantic
kind of thing
glass and steel building. Yeah.
Peering up. Well, what's interesting is, what this is, and this is like, you know, on regarding your point on sort of the changing scale of the city or the change, you know, how do we insert modern buildings in this historic city? One thing that's interesting, as we start engaging height, well, that actually is the next layer because
sure.
now when you're coming across from Cambridge, as I do, to go to Northeastern, I see some markers I didn't see before, a Northeastern dorm. I see one of these buildings in Longwood that mark visually sort of guide my way in a way that wasn't the case before when everything was the same height. So I think that there are some real opportunities for expression. For modern buildings in this historic city.
I want to roll through a couple quick calls before we run out of too much time. Stan is calling from Needham. You're on the air, Stan.
Yes, I just left my visit to the Gardner, the new piano wing, and it was delightful. I enjoyed the space very much, the clean lines, the open, the light. And I didn't see a problem with the entrance. I haven't been to the Gardner in a while, and first thing I remember is the courtyard. And, of course, there's nothing in the new entrance that interferes with the experience of the courtyard, which is the first thing that you really remark when you enter the museum. I think, though, in leaving the Gardner, which is sort of like a heavy French meal, and coming through the crossway into the piano wing, it's almost like a cleansing sorbet or something.
It's a palate cleanser of a building.
Your palate and coming to this new modern space. And I think it's a wonderful addition, and I enjoyed it very much. Also, I've noticed the grounds more, that the Gardner actually has grounds. You don't mm-hmm. notice that when you go through the old entrance, but now you notice that there is grass and there's, you know, it's winter now,
point.
But I'm,
yeah.
I imagine the spring, you're going to see things blooming. And I just thought I thought the contrast was great. And I just enjoyed it very much.
Stan, thank you so much for your call. We're running down on time here. So I want to sort of return back to a question that one listener wants to ask us. And it's something you were hinting at earlier, Sebastian, and that is, just the sort of legal and ethical obligation that the Gardner Museum has to hold fast to the vision of its founder. I mean, that's what the source of the controversy was
right.
when they decided to do this expansion.
Right. Well, I mean, of course, there's her ironclad will, supposedly ironclad, which everyone talks about. But, you know, they went through all the proper authorities and they got the go-ahead to do this. So that's fine. I mean, I think everyone wants to claim that they know what Isabella Stewart Gardner would have wanted and would have felt. And yet the fact remains, we don't know. It's up for grabs. I think that she might have looked at this building and thought, I'm not so sure. On the other hand, it has so much about it that's good. And I think, especially someone mentioned the concert hall before, it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. So everyone should check it out if they can.
And finally, I mean, my last question to all of you, and anyone take your pick, you got a couple seconds to answer, though, and that is, like, these are major institutions in Boston for the purpose of spreading the love and education of art, right? They're not architectural institutions, they're art institutions. So do you think that overall a good balance has been struck that serves art goers and museum goers to the MFA, to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum with these expansions?
I would say much better than most recent museums. I mean, I think that the trend is really going happily towards museums that serve the performance requirements of museums and not so much just the exterior.
Sebastian, as a lover of visual art, do you agree?
Yeah, on the whole, I do, absolutely. I just think that the whole museum building boom is a bit of a worry as well, because there's almost a need for museums to build, and I wonder whether we need to be in such a hurry all the time.
Provocative point to end on.
Indeed. Well, Adam Ragusio is our reporter who took us through the two buildings. Thanks so much, Adam.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I can't believe I get paid for this.
And Sebastian Smee, Pulitzer Prize-winning art critic for the Boston Globe. And your article on the Gardner is in the most recent Globe magazine. Thank you as well. And George Thrush, professor and director of architecture at Northeastern, and you blog about the built environment at Boston Magazine. Great to have you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Listeners, do continue this conversation, especially if you've seen those buildings, at radioboston.org. Coming up, snow is on its way. The skiers say hooray. My back and my shovel, not so much. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.